A Rashi about a pasuk that appears to confuse the sequencing of the travel in the Midbar and a very important and tragic event. In Perek Yud, Pasuk Vav, the Torah describes the Jewish people journeying from a location called Be'eros B'nei Akan, evidently a location surrounding wells of water named after the children of Ya'akan, and they traveled to a location named Mosera. And in this location, the destination of Mosera, to where they traveled from Be'eros B'nei Ya'akan, Aaron dies, he's buried, and he's replaced by his son Elazar. Now Rashi cites two very strange components of this pasuk, and it's really a third one. The third one, which is probably the most macro one, is that this pasuk is 40 years after the previous pasuk. The previous pasuk is the final pasuk detailing the closure of the Egel disaster and the construction of the second luchos and the insertion of those luchos in Aaron. Another interesting Rashi, which Aaron, for some other time. Then the pasuk makes an immediate leap 40 years later to Aaron's death. Rashi doesn't comment on that, interestingly enough, but what he does comment on is, number one, the inversion, because in Parshas Maaseh, the Torah describes them traveling from Mosera to B'nai Akan. The wells of B'nai Akan are the destination they arrive at having departed from Mosera, whereas in Parshas Ekev, they're reversed. They depart from the wells and they arrive at Mosera, as opposed to Parshas Maaseh, where they depart from Mosera and they arrive at the well. So there's almost like an intersection and a conflation between the point of departure and destination. Second issue is, Aaron is described as having died in Mosera, whereas it's pretty clear from Aaron's death, as reported in Chukas, that he dies in Hor HaHar. So Rashi highlights two issues of sequencing and timing that appear to be, as we would say, out of whack. So this is a long Rashi. It covers two psukim. And Rashi tells the following story by piecing together various midrashim. Namely, the itinerary of Parshas Maaseh is the real geographical itinerary. Namely, they travel from Mosera to B'nai Ya'akan, and then after the B'nai Ya'akan wells, they arrive at some point to Hor HaHar. So the sequencing is indeed Mosera, the wells of B'nai Ya'akan, a few other stops, and finally Hor HaHar. But the tragedy and trauma of Aaron's death at Hor HaHar was so debilitating that they went backwards. They traveled backwards, 8 encampments, passing back to their original point of departure, the wells of B'nai Ya'akan, and then back to Mosera, which was the point that they traveled from, reaching B'nai Ya'akan. They were so traumatized and terrified by life without Aaron HaKohen, life without the Anani HaKavod, the specter of Melech Arad, one of the warring chieftains who had residing near Canaan, that they retreated 8 encampments back to B'nai Ya'akan, which was 8 away from Hor HaHar, and then back to Mosera, which was the camp immediately prior to Be'eros B'nai Ya'akan. At this point, an old hero intervenes, the tribe of Levi. They intervene. According to Rashi, they don't just intervene, but they have to launch what is effectively a second civil war. Remember, B'nai Levi were responsible, the tribe of Levi were responsible for the first civil war, routing out the criminals of the Egel. At this point, they have to, 40 years later, rout out and eliminate those who are disheartening and dispiriting the Jewish camp and leading this retreat, which effectively sets its sights 40 years later, nostalgia for Egypt, for the slavery, the bondage, and the persecution. So effectively, Maaseh describes the actual first thrust, Mosera, then the wells of B'nai Ya'akan, ultimately Hor HaHar. Parshas Ekev, Moshe is rebuking them, reminding them of their of their timidity, of their temerity, Moshe reminds them, and effectively they travel backwards from Bnei Akan to Mosera, because they're retreating. And Moshe reminds them of this retreat, and they had only realized the trauma of Aaron's death when they retreated to Mosera, that earliest departure point, at least of the three being described in these psukim, and they had witnessed their disloyalty, had been rallied by the Shevet of Levi. At that point, they mourned Aaron's loss as if he had died in Mosera. So historically, he dies in Hor HaHar. He's buried in Hor HaHar. But Akev, remember, Akev, Moshe takes poetic license, presents details, not necessarily in the factual sense, but in the moral sense. So he describes them as retreating from Bnei Akan to Mosera, and describes Aaron as having died and being replaced in Mosera, in which, in reality, it occurred in Hor HaHar. And of course, this is the transition into the 40th year, so that's why it's juxtaposed with such a drastic leap in time because of the juxtaposition to the ego. Now, there are several things interesting about this Rashi. One, I mentioned that because Moshe is not interested in the facts in Sefer Devarim, but in the moral delivery and the moral message, so he choreographs events and tags them very different from the manner in which they occurred, and Rashi has to decipher and to decode between, or the offset, the discrepancy between the facts of Maaseh and the moral framing of Akev. Second of all, what's fascinating is that they don't realize Aaron's loss morally until a different stage, and sometimes it takes a while for people to absorb loss. Certainly the loss of great people, what they meant to our society, what they meant. I know I'm recording this about a year and change after my Rebbe, Rebbe Lichtenstein, was Nifter, and I feel that so many people are coming to terms with what he meant to our generation and to our community. So it's telling, it's appropriate for Aaron's loss and that great mourning to be conducted in a different location and detached in time, delayed, time delayed. Because when he dies in Hor HaHar, the immediacy of the trauma always doesn't allow you to absorb it in process, but certainly someone has, with the magnitude and the dimension of Aaron HaKohen. What's probably the most striking about this Rashi is the role of Bnei Levi, that they're playing, in some ways, the same role they played 40 years earlier, which is why these two incidents are juxtaposed textually, the Egel and its conclusion, and then right away the leap to this very quiet, concealed insurrection, which Rashi has to tease out from the Pesukim. And even more so that you would have thought that the Bnei Levi would themselves be a little bit handicapped or deadened because it's their leader and their prince who dies. This wasn't just a leader, this was Aaron. And the mourning and the sobbing and the gloom that people felt and the dread at Aaron's loss, they could have easily gotten caught up in it because he's their leader. They could have indulged in it, or at the very least, even if they didn't participate in it, they could have been rendered less capable of opposing that mutiny. But true leaders and in this case, the sect of leaders, are able to see beyond their own prejudices and their own needs. In our jargon, they're not homies. They don't view things through their own personal lenses. And they realize the futility of feeling the inadequacy in the absence of Aaron, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will continue to provide. And obviously, there's a transition. I'll talk about this in another Rashi, between supernatural eras and eras in which we have to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu without Ananiah covered, but still rely upon his protection and his enclosure. So it's a fascinating Rashi, because it has to tease out an event that doesn't occur at all, doesn't appear at all in the text, and the Midrashim have to create that fabric, and Rashi connects various Midrashim. And then there's another Rashi, which is similar in tone, but before I describe the Rashi, I just want to issue a comment to preface. I'd seen this Rashi earlier in the week, and thought about the intriguing machlokas which Rashi presents. And then an event occurred which tragically took the lives of 247 people in Italy in an earthquake. And I don't want anyone listening to the shiur to in any way feel anything less than sensitivity, compassion, sadness at the loss of tragic lives. At the tragic loss of lives, of innocent lives, because I'm describing the earthquake of Korach and different versions of that earthquake and what the symbolism of the earthquake is. And it was never intended as a comment on what's taking place now in Italy. And obviously, as Jews, we suffer terribly when even one life, an innocent life, is taken. Certainly something so shocking and so traumatic as the loss of 270 innocent people, and I'm sure they'll probably discover more bodies. That something which I had planned earlier in the week to started thinking about. And it's a Rashi that cites a contrast between the way Korach's earthquake is described in Parshas Korach and the manner in which the earthquake is described in Parshas Ekev. In Parshas Ekev, in Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Vav, the following term is described. Now, keep in mind, Korach is missing. We don't know what happens to Korach per se in Parshas Ekev. Maybe I'll talk about it a bit later. But the earthquake is described as having swallowed them up, their houses, their tents, their possessions, asher biraglehem, at their feet. The word feet appears. Bekerev kol Yisrael, amidst the entire camp of the Jewish people. That's pretty standard description of an earthquake. Parshas Korach describes Vatiftach haaretz es piha. The earth opened its mouth. Vatibla osam mitzbatehem, and it swallowed them, their homes, all the people. And again, it appears in Parshas Korach that Korach is swallowed. He's not incinerated with his people who brought the guitarists. But for now, it's less important what Korach's ultimate fate was. Based on this offset between the earth opening its mouth, the way it's described in Parshas Korach, and Bekerev Kol Yisrael, a more widespread event. So there's an interesting machlokas, which Rashi quotes. It's really something which appears in several midrashim. I'll read it to you from the Medrash Yalkut Shimoni in Parshas Korach. Rabbi Yehuda felt, one of the Tanaim, that the earth basically opened many mouths. Essentially, our classic earthquake, where the earth splits, the plates shift, and many holes and fissures are opened. To which Rabbi Nechemiah responded, well, what about the singular description of Vatiftach haaretz es piha? The earth opens its mouth in Parshas Korach. So Rabbi Nechemiah envisions one sinkhole, large, opening and engulfing this entire company of people. And then, of course, Rabbi Nechemiah has to defend, well, if there's one hole, Vatiftach haaretz es piha, how do you justify, how do you accommodate Bekerev Kol Yisrael? So he describes a strange scene where wherever a rebel was standing, that land became slanted towards the one hole, and he alone fell into that hole and was gobbled up, as opposed to the innocent Jew standing alongside of him. His vector, the land he was standing, wasn't indented, and he didn't fall along that little, along the slope down into the hole. Now, obviously, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nechemiah are arguing about which word is more compelling, whether the vision or the image of a tiftach haaretz es piha, which according to Rabbi Nechemiah suggests one hole, and he'll justify the word Bekerev Kol Yisrael, which is suggestive of many holes in Parshas Ekev. And Rabbi Yehuda feels that Bekerev Kol Yisrael, the more classic image of many crevices and many cracks in the earth, and the classic earthquake. Without question, and to a degree, regardless of what happened historically, once again, there is one presentation in Sefer Bamidbar, in the event, as the events are unfolding in real time, and this is a totally different image that's being cast by Moshe Rabbeinu in Parshas Ekev. Rabbi Yehuda believes that the image of Moshe is the historically accurate one. Rabbi Nechemiah believes that the image in Parshas Korach is the historically accurate one. But why are those different images placed where they are? Part of the answer is as follows. In Parshas Korach, the contest is theological. This is still on the heels of, this is still year 2, believe it or not, year 40 only occurs in Parshas Chukas, after Korach. And the Jewish people are still struggling with promises of Eretz Yisrael, which they've betrayed, monotheism, which they have disdained at the Egel, and now HaKadosh Baruch Hu's authority as vested in Moshe, which they're challenging. And if they're not challenging HaKadosh Baruch Hu, they're challenging Moshe's authority to showcase HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will and the selection that HaKadosh Baruch Hu can select and create divisions in this world. So it may not be questioning Hashem's presence, but it's still theological. And a theological challenge demands a theological response, which is why It has to be supernatural, because keep in mind that one sinkhole is not the classic earthquake. Sadly enough, earthquakes occur as part of the natural cycle, part of plates shifting, fault lines, tremors. Sadly, people suffer. People lost their lives in Italy because of that type of an earthquake. But that's not what's described in Korach. In Korach, something supernatural, something beyond human experience and human phenomena. And Moshe is aware of that. Moshe says, "V'im bri'ah yivra Hashem." Hashem was going to create something new, something different. And indeed, "V'ahi kichal l'sol l'daber," immediately after Moshe speaks, "V'tibaka damar shetachtehem, v'tiftach aretz es piha v'tibla osam esbatehem." Indeed, something is created. It's once again affirming HaKadosh Baruch Hu theologically as the creator and as the dictator of boundaries, of differences, of selection, of dry land versus water, stable land versus unstable land. So it has a feel of Sefer Bereishis. It has the feel of a supernatural event that occurs once in history to affirm some aspect of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's authority and authorship and decision-making authority, which Korach is questioning through the selection of Moshe Rabbeinu. It has, to a degree, a feel of Sefer Bereishis because it inverts Sefer Bereishis. In Bereishis, human life stems at some point from the ground. Hashem collects the ground and creates life. Now the ground literally swallows life and engulfs life. So it's a real visceral image, the reversal of Maaseh Bereishis, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu issuing an adamant statement about his role in Maaseh Bereishis, not just in the natural world, but in human interactions and in the hierarchy that has been established. That's not Moshe's challenge in Parshas Ekev. In Parshas Ekev, Moshe's challenge is the supernatural events are fading. Mentioned before, Aaron has died. There are no longer glorious clouds, Anani HaKavod, engulfing and enclosing and protecting. Now the Jewish people have to learn to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hand and presence and message and will in nature itself. In nature, whether it's day-to-day routine or cataclysms of nature, but still part of the natural process. Interestingly enough, a few psukim beforehand, as Moshe is exhorting them to follow HaKadosh Baruch Hu's commands and listen to his messages, Kriyas Yamsuf is cast in a very interesting fashion. Remember all the osos, Moshe says, and what Hashem did to the armies of Egypt, to the horses, to the chariots. He drowned them in the Yamsuf. There's no mention of the Jewish people passing through the Yamsuf in dry land. If you were to mention what's more striking of Yamsuf, when I said the word Kriyas Yamsuf, what image first leaps to mind? It's the Jewish people walking through the Yamsuf. Nitzvu kamo neidin ozlim, at least half of Shiras Hayam, is dedicated to the water standing still, not just to the drowning of the Egyptians. But Moshe is not interested in the water standing still for the Jewish people, because that won't happen again. That's not something that will guard them against all the moral and ultimately theological betrayals that await them. But drownings and floods and natural disasters will. So the drowning of the Egyptians is invoked, as is, sadly, again, in the context of this week's events, as is the Korach event is now cast as an earthquake. This is the classic earthquake. This is where the earth beneath your legs shakes, and that's what makes the earthquake experience so terrifying. That's why the term Asher Biraglehem is described. Bekerev Kol Yisrael, it has a sweep amongst the entire camp, as earthquakes do. It has a radius and a midpoint and a core, but it emanates broadly. And Moshe is attempting to draw their attention to trying to understand, where possible, the hand of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in events that are not supernatural, even though they may occur infrequently in the natural disasters. And perhaps we live in an era in which it's difficult to connect the dots. We're so far downstream in history, it wouldn't just be morally insensitive to start to decode why an earthquake occurred in Italy. It would be intellectually dishonest. We have no tools, and we recoil when some people try to play God. And so these statements shouldn't be taken literally in the context of this week, but we certainly should try to trace HaKadosh Baruch Hu's role and what are his expectations of us. We're no longer in the world of prophecy. We don't possess Nevi'im. We don't possess Nevuah. what are the messages that Kadosh Baruch Hu sends us in broad strokes when there's a famine, when there's such a limited rainfall, a shortage of rain, when there are terror incidents. However, whatever those messages are, in very, very broad strokes, that's part of connecting the dots between religion, your relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and your religious level, and whatever messages HaKadosh Baruch Hu sends you. So, what's interesting is, again, not factually what happened, and again, it could have been a little bit of each, and Rabbi Huda chose one, or Rabbi Chemni chose another, but why Rabbi Nechemya's version is highlighted in Korach, and Rabbi Huda's version is highlighted in Parshas Ekev. So these are two very, very subtle Rashis, one about the great retreat, and one about the earthquake. Shabbat Shalom.